say?
You know what words. At the threshold, with the cameras rolling.
Will there be cameras?
Oh, I'm sure there'll be all sorts of documentation. It's only proper, considering.
So we need something to say, a memorable phrase.
I was thinking of, this is a momentous moment in human history.
Momentous moment? Norman said, frowning.
You're right, Ted said. Awkward, I agree. Maybe a turning point in human history?
Norman shook his head.
How about a crossroads in the evolution of the human species?
Can evolution have a crossroads?
I don't see why not, Ted said.
Well, a crossroads is a crossing of roads. Is evolution a road?
I thought it wasn't. I thought evolution was undirected.
You're being too literal, Ted said.
Reading the bottom, the pilot said. 900 feet.
He slowed the descent. They heard the intermittent ping of sonar.
Ted said, a new threshold in the evolution of the human species?
Sure. Think it will be?
Will be what?
A new threshold?
Why not?
Ted said. What if we open it up and it's just a lot of rusted junk inside and nothing valuable or enlightening at all?
Good point, Ted said. 950 feet. Exterior lights are on,
the pilot said. Through the porthole they saw white flecks. The pilot explained this was suspended matter in the water.
Visual contact. I have bottom.
Oh, let's see, Ted said. The pilot obligingly shifted to one side, and they looked. Norman saw a flat, dead, dull brown plain, stretching away to the limit of the lights, blackness beyond.
Not much to look at right here, I'm afraid, the pilot said.
Surprisingly dreary, Ted said, without a trace of disappointment.
I would have expected more life. Well, it's pretty cold. Water temperature is 36 degrees Fahrenheit.
Almost freezing, Ted said.
Yes, sir. Let's see if we can find your new home.
The motors rumbled. Muddy sediment churned up in front of the porthole. The sub turned, moved across the bottom. For several minutes, they saw only the brown landscape. Then, lights.
There we are.
A vast underwater array of lights, arranged in a rectangular pattern.
That's the grid, the pilot said.
The submarine planed up and glided smoothly over the illuminated grid, which extended into the distance for half a mile. Through the porthole, they saw divers standing on the bottom, working within the grid structure. The divers waved to the passing sub. The pilot honked a toy horn.
They can hear that? Oh, sure, water's a great conductor.
My God, Ted said. Directly ahead, the giant titanium fin rose sharply above the ocean floor. Norman was completely unprepared for its dimension. As the submarine moved to port, the fin blocked their entire field of view for nearly a minute. The metal was dull gray and, except for small white speckles of marine growth, entirely unmarked.
There isn't any corrosion, Ted said.
No, sir, the pilot said.
Everybody's mentioned that. They think it's because it's a metal-plastic alloy, but I don't think anybody is quite sure.
The fin slipped away to the stern. The submarine again turned. Directly ahead, more lights, arranged in vertical rows. Norman saw a single cylinder of yellow-painted steel and bright portholes. Next to it was a low metal dome.
That's DH-7, the diver's habitat, to port, the pilot said. It's pretty utilitarian. You guys are in DH-8, which is much nicer, believe me.
He turned starboard, and after a momentary blackness, they saw another set of lights. Coming closer, Norman counted 5 different cylinders, some vertical, some horizontal, interconnected in a complex way.
There you are, DH-8, your home away from home, the pilot said. Give me a minute to dock.
Metal clanged against metal. There was a sharp jolt, and then the motors cut off. Silence. Hissing air. The pilot scrambled to open the hatch, and surprisingly cold air washed down on them.
Airlock's open, gentlemen,
he said, stepping aside. Norman looked up through the lock. He saw banks of red lights above. He climbed up through the submarine
and into a round steel cylinder approximately 8 feet in diameter. On all sides there were handholds, a narrow metal bench, the glowing heat lamps overhead, though they didn't seem to do much good. Ted climbed up and sat on the bench opposite him. They were so close their knees touched. Below their feet, the pilot closed the hatch. They watched the wheel spin. They heard a clank as the submarine disengaged, then the whirr of motors as it moved away. Then, nothing. "What happens now?" Norman said. "They pressurize us," Ted said. "Switch us over to exotic gas atmosphere. We can't breathe air down here." "Why not?" Norman said. Now that he was down here, staring at the cold steel walls of the cylinder, he wished he had stayed awake for the breathing. "Because," Ted said, "the atmosphere of the Earth is deadly. You don't realize it, but oxygen is a corrosive gas. It's in the same chemical family as chlorine and fluorine, and hydrofluoric acid is the most corrosive acid known. The same quality of oxygen that makes a half-eaten apple turn brown or makes iron rust is incredibly destructive to the human body if exposed to too much of it. Oxygen under pressure is toxic, with a vengeance. So we cut down the amount of oxygen you breathe. You breathe 21% oxygen at the surface. Down here you breathe 2% oxygen, but you won't notice any difference." A voice over a loudspeaker said, "We're starting to pressurize you now." "Who's that?" Norman said. "Barnes," the voice said, but it didn't sound like Barnes. It sounded gritty and artificial. "It must be the talker," Ted said, and then laughed. His voice was noticeably higher pitched. "It's the helium, Norman. They're pressurizing us with helium." "You sound like Donald Duck," Norman said, and he laughed too. His own voice sounded squeaky, like a cartoon character's.
"Speak for yourself, Mickey," Ted squeaked. "I thought I saw a footy tap," Norman said.
They were both laughing, hearing their voices.
"Knock it off, you guys," Barnes said over the intercom. "This is serious."
"Yes, sir, Captain,"
Ted said, but by now his voice was so high-pitched that it was almost unintelligible, and they fell into laughter again, their tinny voices like those of schoolgirls reverberating inside the steel cylinder. Helium made their voices high and squeaky, but it also had other effects.
"Getting chilled, boys?"
Barnes said. They were indeed getting colder. He saw Ted shivering, felt goosebumps on his own legs. It felt as if a wind were blowing across their bodies, except there wasn't any wind. The lightness of the helium increased evaporation, made them cold. Across the cylinder, Ted said something, but Norman couldn't understand Ted at all anymore. His voice was too high-pitched to be comprehensible. It was just a thin squeal.
"Sounds like a couple of rats in there now," Barnes said with satisfaction.
Ted rolled his eyes toward the loudspeaker and squeaked something.
"If you want to talk, get a talker," Barnes said. "You'll find them in the locker under the seat."
Norman found a metal locker, clicked it open. The metal squealed loudly like chalk on a blackboard. All the sounds in the chamber were high-pitched. Inside the locker, he saw two black plastic pads with neck straps.
"Just slip them over your neck. Put the pad at the base of your throat."
"Okay," Ted said, and then blinked in surprise. His voice sounded slightly rough, but otherwise normal. "These things must change the vocal cord frequencies," Norman said.
"Why don't you guys pay attention to briefings?" Barnes said. "That's exactly what they do. You'll have to wear a talker all the time you're down here, at least if you want anybody to understand you. Still cold?"
"Yes,"
Ted said.
"Well, hang on. You're almost fully pressurized now."
Then there was another hiss, and a side door slid open. Barnes stood there with light jackets over his arm.
"Welcome to DH-8, he said.
DH-8.
"You're the last to arrive," Barnes said. "We just have time for a quick tour before we open the spacecraft."
"You're ready to open it now?" Ted asked.
"Wonderful. I've just been talking about this with Norman. This is such a great moment, our first contact with alien life. We ought to prepare a little speech for when we open it up."
"There'll be time to consider that," Barnes said, with an odd glance at Ted. "I'll show you the habitat first, this way." He explained that the DH-8 habitat consisted of five large cylinders, designated A to E. Sill A is the airlock where we are now. He led them into an adjacent changing room. Heavy cloth suits hung limply on the wall, alongside yellow sculpted helmets of the sort Norman had seen the divers wearing. The helmets had a futuristic look. Norman tapped one with his knuckles. It was plastic and surprisingly light. He saw Johnson stenciled above one faceplate. "We going to wear these?" Norman asked.
"That's correct," Barnes said.
"Then we'll be going outside?" Norman said, feeling a twinge of alarm.
"Eventually, yes. Don't worry about it now.
Still cold?" They were. Barnes had them change into tight-fitting jumpsuits of clinging blue polyester. Ted frowned. "Don't you think these look a little silly?"
"They may not be the height of fashion," Barnes said, "but they prevent heat loss from helium."
"The color is unflattering," Ted said.
"Screw the color," Barnes said.
He handed them lightweight jackets. Norman felt something heavy in one pocket and pulled out a battery pack.
"The jackets are wired and electrically heated," Barnes said. "Like an electric blanket, which is what you'll use for sleeping. Follow me."
They went on to Sill B, which housed power and life support systems. At first glance, it looked like a large boiler room, all multicolored pipes and utilitarian fittings.
"This is where we generate all of our heat, power, and air," Barnes said.
He pointed out the features.
"Closed cycle IC generator, 24110, hydrogen and oxygen-driven fuel cells, LSS monitors, liquid processor runs on silver-zinc batteries. And that's Chief Petty Officer Fletcher. Teeny Fletcher."
Norman saw a big-boned figure working back among the pipes with a heavy wrench. The figure turned. Alice Fletcher gave them a grin, waved a greasy hand.
"She seems to know what she's doing," Ted said approvingly.
"She does," Barnes said. "But all the major support systems are redundant. Fletcher is just our final redundancy. Actually, you'll find the entire habitat is self-regulating."
He clipped heavy badges onto the jumpsuits.
"Wear these at all times, even though they're just a precaution. The alarms trigger automatically if life support conditions go below optimum. But that won't happen. There are sensors in each room of the habitat. You'll get used to the fact that the environment continually adjusts to your presence. Lights will go on and off, heat lamps will turn on and off, and air vents will hiss to keep track of things. It's all automatic, don't sweat it. Every single major system is redundant. We can lose power, we can lose air, we can lose water entirely, and we will be fine for 130 hours.
130 hours didn't sound very long to Norman. He did the calculation in his head. 5 days. 5 days didn't seem very long either. They went into the next cylinder, the lights clicking on as they entered. Cylinder C contained living quarters, bunks, toilets, showers, plenty of hot water, you'll find. Barnes showed them around proudly, as if it were a hotel. The living quarters were heavily insulated, carpeted deck, walls, and ceilings, all covered in soft padded foam, which made the interior appear like an overstuffed couch. But despite the bright colors and the evident care in decoration, Norman still found it cramped and dreary. The portholes were tiny, and they revealed only the blackness of the ocean outside. And wherever the padding ended, he saw heavy bolts and heavy steel plating, a reminder of where they really were. He felt as if he were inside a large iron lung, and he thought, that isn't so far wrong. They ducked through narrow bulkheads into D-sill, a small laboratory with benches and microscopes on the top level, a compact electronics unit on the level below.
"This is Tina Chan,"
Barnes said, introducing a very still woman. They all shook hands. Norman thought that Tina Chan was almost unnaturally calm, until he realized she was one of those people who almost never blinked their eyes.
"Be nice to Tina," Barnes was saying. "She's our only link to the outside. She runs the comm ops and the sensor systems as well. In fact, all the electronics."
Tina Chan was surrounded by the bulkiest monitors Norman had ever seen. They looked like TV sets from the 1950s. Barnes explained that certain equipment didn't do well in the helium atmosphere, including TV tubes. In the early days of undersea habitats, the tubes had to be replaced daily. Now they were elaborately coated and shielded, hence their bulk. Next to Chan was another woman, Jane Edmonds, whom Barnes introduced as the unit archivist.
"What's a unit archivist?" Ted asked her.
Petty Officer First Class Data Processing, sir, she said formally. Jane Edmonds wore spectacles and stood stiffly. She reminded Norman of a librarian. Data processing? Ted said. My mission is to keep all the digital recordings, visual materials, and videotapes, sir. Every aspect of this historic moment is being recorded, and I keep everything neatly filed. Norman thought, she is a librarian.
Oh, excellent, Ted said.
I'm glad to hear it. Film or tape? Tape, sir.
I know my way around a video camera, Ted said with a smile. What are you putting it down on, half-inch or three-quarter?
Sir, we use a data scan image equivalent of 2,000 pixels per side-biased frame, each pixel carrying a 12-tone grayscale.
Oh,
Ted said. It's a bit better than commercial systems you may be familiar with, sir.
I see, Ted said, but he recovered smoothly and chatted with Edmonds for a while about technical matters.
Ted seems awfully interested in how we're going to record this, Barnes said, looking uneasy.
Yes, he seems to be.
Norman wondered why that troubled Barnes. Was Barnes worried about the visual record? Or did he think Ted would try to hog the show?
Would Ted try to hog the show? Did Barnes have any worries about having this appear to be a civilian operation?
No, the exterior lights are 150-watt quartz halogen, Edmonds was saying. We're recording at equivalent of 500,000 ASA, so that's ample. The real problem is backscatter. We're constantly fighting it.
Norman said, I notice your support team is all women.
Yes, Barnes said. All the deep diving studies show that women are superior for submerged operations. They're physically smaller and consume less nutrients and air. They have better social skills and tolerate close quarters better. And they are physiologically tougher and have better endurance. The fact is, the Navy long ago recognized that all their submariners should be female.
He laughed.
But just try to implement that one.
He glanced at his watch.
We'd better move on, Ted.
They went on. The final cylinder, E-Sill, was more spacious than the others. There were magazines, a television, and a large lounge, and on the deck below was an efficient mess and a kitchen. Seaman Rose Levy, the cook, was a red-faced woman with a southern accent, standing beneath giant suction fans. She asked Norman whether he had any favorite desserts.
Desserts?
Yes, sir, Dr. Johnson. I like to make everybody's favorite dessert if I can.
What about you? You have a favorite, Dr. Fielding?
Key lime pie, Ted said. I love key lime pie.
Can do, sir,
Levy said with a big smile.
She turned back to Norman.
I haven't heard yours yet, Dr. Johnson.
Strawberry shortcake.
Easy.
Got some nice New Zealand strawberries coming down on the last sub-shuttle. Maybe you'd like that shortcake tonight?
Why not, Rose?
Barnes said heartily. Norman looked out the black porthole window. From the portholes of D-Sill, he could see the rectangular illuminated grid that extended across the bottom, following the half-mile-long buried spacecraft. Divers, illuminated like fireflies, moved over the glowing grid surface. Norman thought, I am 1,000 feet beneath the surface of the ocean, and we are talking about whether we should have strawberry shortcake for dessert. But the more he thought about it, the more it made sense. The best way to make somebody comfortable in a new environment was to give him familiar food.
Strawberries make me break out, Ted said. I'll make your shortcake with blueberries, Levy said, not missing a beat.
And whipped cream? Ted said.
Well,
you can't have everything, Barnes said. And one of the things you can't have at 30 atmospheres of mixed gas is whipped cream. Won't whip. Let's move on.
Beth and Harry were waiting in the small padded conference room directly above the mess. They both wore jumpsuits and heated jackets. Harry was shaking his head as they arrived.
Like our padded cell? He poked the insulated walls. It's like living in a vagina.
Beth said, don't you like going back to the womb, Harry?
No, Harry said. I've been there. Once was enough.
These jumpsuits are pretty bad, Ted said, plucking at the clinging polyester.
Shows your belly nicely, Harry said. Let's settle down, Barnes said.
A few sequins, you could be Elvis Presley, Harry said.
Elvis Presley's dead.
Now's your chance, Harry said.
Norman looked around. Where's Levine?
Levine didn't make it, Barnes said briskly. He got claustrophobic in the sub coming down and had to be taken back. One of those things.
Then we have no marine biologist?
We'll manage without him.
I hate this damn jumpsuit, Ted said. I really hate it.
Beth looks good in hers.
Yes, Beth works out.
And it's damp in here, too, Ted said.
Is it always so damp?
Norman had noticed that humidity was a problem. Everything they touched felt slightly wet and clammy and cold. Barnes warned them of the danger of infections and minor colds and handed out bottles of skin lotion and eardrops.
I thought you said the technology was all worked out, Harry said.
It is, Barnes said. Believe me, this is plush compared to the habitats 10 years ago.
10 years ago, Harry said, they stopped making habitats because people kept dying in them.
Barnes frowned. There was one accident.
There were two accidents, Harry said, a total of 4 people.
Special circumstances, Barnes said, not involving Navy technology or personnel.
Great, Harry said. How long did you say we were going to be down here?
Maximum 72 hours, Barnes said.
You sure about that?
It's Navy regs, Barnes said.
Why? Norman asked, puzzled.
Barnes shook his head.
Never, he said, never ask a reason for Navy regulations.
The intercom clicked, and Tina Chan said, Captain Barnes, we have a signal from the divers. They are mounting the airlock now. Another few minutes to open. The feeling in the room changed immediately. The excitement was palpable. Ted rubbed his hands together. He realized, of course, that even without opening that spacecraft, we have already made a major discovery of profound importance.
What's that? Norman said.
We've shot the unique event hypothesis to hell, Ted said, glancing at Beth.
The unique event hypothesis? Barnes said.
He's referring, Beth said, to the fact that physicists and chemists tend to believe in intelligent extraterrestrial life, while biologists tend not to. Many biologists feel the development of intelligent life on Earth required so many peculiar steps that it represents a unique event in the universe that may never have occurred elsewhere.
Wouldn't intelligence arise again and again? Barnes said.
Well, it barely arose on the Earth, Beth said. The Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and single-celled life appeared 3.9 billion years ago, almost immediately, geologically speaking. But life remained single-celled for the next 3 billion years. Then in the Cambrian period, around 600 million years ago, there was an explosion of sophisticated life forms. Within 100 million years, the ocean was full of fish. Then the land became populated, then the air. But nobody knows why the explosion occurred in the first place. And since it didn't occur for 3 billion years, there's the possibility that on some other planet it might never occur at all. And even after the Cambrian, the chain of events leading to man appears to be so special, so chancy, that biologists worry it might never have happened. Just consider the fact that if the dinosaurs hadn't been wiped out 65 million years ago by a comet or whatever, then reptiles might still be the dominant form on Earth, and mammals would never have had a chance to take over. No mammals, no primates. No primates, no apes. No apes, no man. There are a lot of random factors in evolution. A lot of luck. That's why biologists think intelligent life might be a unique event in the universe, only occurring here. Except now, Ted said, we know it's not a unique event, because there is a damn big spacecraft out there.
Personally, Beth said, I couldn't be more pleased. She bit her lip.
You don't look pleased, Norman said.
I tell you, Beth said, I can't help being nervous. 10 years ago, Bill Jackson at Stanford ran a series of weekend seminars on extraterrestrial life. This was right after he won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. He split us into 2 groups. One group designed the alien life form and worked it all out scientifically. The other group tried to figure out the life form and communicate with it. Jackson presided over the whole thing as a hard scientist, not letting anybody get carried away. One time we brought in a sketch of a proposed creature, and he said, very tough, okay, where's the anus? That was his criticism. But many animals on Earth have no anus. There are all kinds of excretory mechanisms that don't require a special orifice. Jackson assumed an anus was necessary, but it isn't. And now? She shrugged. Who knows what we'll find?
We'll know soon enough, Ted said.
The intercom clicked. Captain Barnes, the divers have the airlock mounted in place. The robot is now ready to enter the spacecraft. Ted said, "What robot?" The door. "I don't think it's appropriate at all," Ted said angrily. "We came down here to make a manned entry into this alien spacecraft. I think we should do what we came here to do, make a manned entry."
"Absolutely not," Barnes said. "We can't risk it."
"You must think of this," Ted said, "as an archaeological site. Greater than Chichen Itza, greater than Troy, greater than Tutankhamun's tomb. Unquestionably the most important archaeological site in the history of mankind. Do you really intend to have a damned robot open that site? Where's your sense of human destiny?"
"Where's your sense of self-preservation?" Barnes said.
"I strongly object, Captain Barnes."
"Duly noted," Barnes said, turning away. "Now let's get on with it. Tina, give us the video feed."
Ted sputtered, but he fell silent as two large monitors in front of them clicked on. On the left screen, they saw the complex tubular metal scaffolding of the robot, with exposed motors and gears. The robot was positioned before the curved gray metal wall of the spacecraft. Within that wall was a door that looked rather like an airliner door. The second screen gave a closer view of the door, taken by the video camera mounted on the robot itself. "It's rather similar to an airplane door," Ted said. Norman glanced at Harry, who smiled enigmatically. Then he looked at Barnes. Barnes did not appear surprised. Barnes already knew about the door, he realized. "I wonder how we can account for such parallelism in door design," Ted said. "The likelihood of its occurring by chance is astronomically small. Why, this door is the perfect size and shape for a human being."
"That's right," Harry said.
"It's incredible," Ted said. "Quite incredible." Harry smiled, said nothing.
Barnes said, "Let's find control surfaces."
The robot video scanner moved left and right across the spacecraft hull. It stopped on the image of a rectangular panel mounted to the left of the door.
"Can you open that panel?"
"Working on it now, sir." Whirring, the robot claw extended out toward the panel. But the claw was clumsy. It scraped against the metal, leaving a series of gleaming scratches. But the panel remained closed. "Ridiculous," Ted said. "It's like watching a baby." The claw continued to scratch at the panel. "We should be doing this ourselves," Ted said.
"Use suction," Barnes said.
Another arm extended out with a rubber sucker. "Ah, the plumber's friend," Ted said disdainfully. As they watched, the sucker attached to the panel flattened. Then, with a click, the panel lifted open. "At last! I can't see..." The view inside the panel was blurred, out of focus. They could distinguish what appeared to be a series of colored, round, metal protrusions, red, yellow, and blue. There were also intricate black-and-white symbols above the knobs. "Look," Ted said. "Red, blue, yellow. Primary colors. This is a very big break."
"Why?" Norman said.
"Because it suggests that the aliens have the same sensory equipment that we do. They may see the universe the same way, visually, in the same colors, utilizing the same part of the electromagnetic spectrum. That's going to help immeasurably in making contact with them. And those black and white markings? That must be some of their writing. Can you imagine? Alien writing." He smiled enthusiastically. "This is a great moment," he said. "I feel truly privileged to be here."
"Focus," Barnes called.
"Focusing now, sir."
The image became even more blurred. "No, the other way."
"Yes, sir, focusing now."
The image changed, slowly resolved into sharp focus.
"Uh-oh," Ted said, staring at the screen. They now saw that the blurred knobs were actually three colored buttons, yellow, red, and blue. The buttons were each an inch in diameter and had knurled or machined edges. The symbols above the buttons resolved sharply into a series of neatly stenciled labels. From left to right, the labels read, "Emergency Ready," "Emergency Lock," and "Emergency Open," in English. There was a moment of stunned silence, and then, very softly,
Harry Adams began to laugh. The spacecraft.
That's English, Ted said, staring at the screen. Written English.
Yeah, Harry said. Sure is.
What's going on? Ted said. Is this some kind of joke?
No, Harry said. He was calm, oddly detached.
How could this spacecraft be 300 years old and carry instructions in modern English?
Think about it, Harry said. Ted frowned.
Maybe, he said, this alien spacecraft is somehow presenting itself to us in a way that will make us comfortable.
Think about it some more, Harry said. There was a short silence.
Well, if it is an alien spacecraft...
It's not an alien spacecraft, Harry said. There was another silence. Then Ted said,
Well, why don't you just tell us all what it is, since you're so sure of yourself?
All right, Harry said. It's an American spacecraft.
An American spacecraft? Half a mile long, made with technology we don't have yet, and buried for 300 years?
Of course, Harry said. It's been obvious from the start. Right, Captain Barnes? We had considered it, Barnes admitted. The President had considered it.
That's why you didn't inform the Russians.
Exactly. By now, Ted was completely frustrated. He clenched his fists as if he wanted to hit someone. He looked from one person to another.
But how did you know?
The first clue, Harry said, came from the condition of the craft itself. It shows no damage whatever. Its condition is pristine. Yet any spacecraft that crashes in water will be damaged. Even at low entry velocities, say 200 miles an hour, the surface of water is as hard as concrete. No matter how strong this craft is, you would expect some degree of damage from the impact with the water. Yet it has no damage.
Meaning?
Meaning it didn't land in the water.
I don't understand. It must have flown here.
It didn't fly here. It arrived here.
From where?
From the future, Harry said. This is some kind of Earth craft that was, will be, made in the future, and has traveled backward in time and appeared under our ocean several hundred years ago.
Why would people in the future do that? Ted groaned.
He was clearly unhappy to be deprived of his alien craft, his great historical moment. He slumped in a chair and stared dully at the monitor screens. I don't know why people in the future would do that, Harry said. We're not there yet. Maybe it was an accident, unintended. Let's go ahead and open it up, Barnes said. Opening, sir. The robot hand moved forward toward the open button. The hand pressed several times. There was a clanking sound, but nothing happened. What's wrong? Barnes said.
Sir, we're not able to impact the button. The extensor arm is too large to fit inside the panel.
Great.
Shall I try the probe?
Try the probe. The claw hand moved back, and a thin needle probe extended out toward the button. The probe slid forward, adjusted position delicately, touched the button. It pushed and slipped off.
Trying again, sir.
The probe again pressed the button and again slid off.
Sir, the surface is too slippery.
Keep trying.
You know, Ted said thoughtfully, this is still a remarkable situation. In one sense, it's even more remarkable than contact with extraterrestrials. I was already quite certain that extraterrestrial life exists in the universe, but time travel? Frankly, as an astrophysicist, I had my doubts. From everything we know, it's impossible, contradicted by the laws of physics. And yet, now we have proof that time travel is possible, and that our own species will do it in the future.
Ted was smiling, wide-eyed and happy again. You had to admire him, Norman thought. He was so wonderfully irrepressible.
And here we are, Ted said, on the threshold of our first contact with our species from the future. Think of it. We are going to meet ourselves from some future time.
The probe pressed again and again, without success.
Sir, we cannot impact the button.
I see that, Barnes said, standing up. Okay, shut it down and get it out of there. Ted, looks like you're going to get your wish after all.
We'll have to go in and open it up manually. Let's suit up.
Into the ship. In the changing room in Cylinder A, Norman stepped into his suit. Tina and Edmonds helped fit the helmet over his head and snap-locked the ring at the neck. He felt the heavy weight of the rebreather tanks on his back. The straps pressed into his shoulder. He tasted metallic air. There was a crackle as his helmet intercom came on. The first words he heard were, "What about at the threshold of a great opportunity for the human species?" Norman laughed, grateful for the break in the tension. "You find it funny?" Ted asked, offended. Norman looked across the room at the suited man with Fielding stenciled on his yellow helmet. "No," Norman said. "I'm just nervous."
"Me too," Beth said.
"Nothing to it," Barnes said. "Trust me." "What are the three biggest lies in DH-8? Harry said, and they laughed again. They crowded together into the tiny airlock, bumping helmeted heads, and the bulkhead hatch to the left was sealed, the wheel spinning. Barnes said, "Okay, folks, just breathe easy." He opened the lower hatch, exposing black water. The water did not rise into the compartment. "The habitat's on positive pressure," Barnes said. "The level won't come up. Now watch me and do this the way I do. You don't want to tear your suit." Moving awkwardly with the weight of the tanks, he crouched down by the hatch, gripped the side handholds, and let go, disappearing with a soft splash. One by one, they dropped down to the floor of the ocean. Norman gasped as near-freezing water enveloped his suit. Immediately, he heard the hum of a tiny fan as the electrical heaters in his suit activated. His feet touched soft, muddy ground. He looked around in the darkness. He was standing beneath the habitat. Directly ahead, 100 yards away, was the glowing rectangular grid. Barnes was already striding forward, leaning into the current, moving slowly like a man on the moon.
"Isn't this fantastic?"
"Calm down, Ted," Harry said. Beth said, "Actually, it's odd how little life there is down here. Have you noticed? Not a sea fan, not a slug, not a sponge, not a solitary fish. Nothing but empty brown seafloor. This must be one of those dead spots in the Pacific." A bright light came on behind him. Norman's own shadow was cast forward on the bottom. He looked back and saw Edmonds holding a camera and light in a bulky waterproof housing. "We recording all this?"
"Yes, sir."
"Try not to fall down, Norman," Beth laughed. "I'm trying." They were closer now to the grid. Norman felt better seeing the other divers working there. To the right was the high fin extending out of the coral, an enormous, smooth, dark surface dwarfing them as it rose toward the surface. Barnes led them past the fin and down into a tunnel cut in the coral. The tunnel was 60 feet long, narrow, strung with lights. They walked single file. It felt like going down into a mine, Norman thought.
"This what the divers cut?"
"That's right." Norman saw a boxy, corrugated steel structure surrounded by pressure tanks. "Airlock ahead. We're almost there," Barnes said. "Everybody okay?"
"So far,"
Harry said. They entered the airlock, and Barnes closed the door. Air hissed loudly. Norman watched the water recede down past his face plate, then his waist, his knees, then to the floor. The hissing stopped, and they passed through another door, sealing it behind them. Norman turned to the metal hull of the spaceship. The robot had been moved aside. Norman felt very much as if he were standing alongside a big jetliner, a curved metal surface and a flush door. The metal was a dull gray, which gave it an ominous quality. Despite himself, Norman was nervous. Listening to the way the others were breathing, he sensed they were nervous too.
"Okay," Barnes said. "Everybody here?"
Edmonds said, "Wait for video, please, sir."
"Okay, waiting."
They all lined up beside the door, but they still had their helmets on. It wasn't going to be much of a picture, Norman thought.
Edmonds, "Tape is running."
Ted, "I'd like to say a few words."
Harry,
"Jesus, Ted, can't you ever let up?"
Ted, "I think it's important."
Harry, "Go ahead, make your speech."
Ted,
Hello, this is Ted Fielding, here at the door of the unknown spacecraft which has been discovered...
Barnes, wait a minute, Ted. Here at the door of the unknown spacecraft sounds like here at the tomb of the unknown soldier.
Ted, you don't like it?
Barnes, well, I think it has the wrong associations.
Ted, I thought you would like it.
Beth,
can we just get on with it, please?
Ted,
never mind.
Harry, what, are you going to pout now?
Ted, never mind. We'll do without any commentary on this historic moment.
Harry, okay, fine. Let's get it open.
Ted, I think everybody knows how I feel. I feel that we should have some brief remarks for posterity.
Harry,
well, make your goddamn remarks.
Ted,
listen, you son of a bitch. I've had about enough of your superior know-it-all attitude.
Barnes, stop tape, please.
Edmonds, tape is stopped, sir.
Barnes, let's everyone settle down.
Harry, I consider all this ceremony utterly irrelevant.
Ted,
well, it's not irrelevant, it's appropriate.
Barnes, all right, I'll do it. Roll the tape.
Edmonds, tape is rolling.
Barnes, this is Captain Barnes. We are now about to open the hatch cover. Present with me on this historic occasion are Ted Fielding, Norman Johnson, Beth Halpern, and Harry Adams.
Harry, why am I last?
Barnes, I did it left to right, Harry.
Harry, isn't it funny the only black man is named last?
Barnes, Harry, it's left to right the way we're standing here.
Harry, and after the only woman. I'm a full professor. Beth is only an assistant professor.
Beth,
Harry,
Ted,
you know how... Perhaps we should be identified by our full titles and institutional affiliations.
Harry,
what's wrong with alphabetical order?
Barnes,
that's it. Forget it. No tape.
Edmonds, tape is off, sir.
Barnes,
Jesus Christ.
He turned away from the group, shaking his helmeted head. He flipped up the metal plate, exposed the two buttons, and pushed one. A yellow light blinked. Ready.
Everybody stay on internal air, Barnes said.
They all continued to breathe from their tanks, in case the interior gases in the spacecraft were toxic.
Everybody ready?
Ready. Barnes pushed the button marked open. With a rumble, the door slid open sideways, just like an airplane door. For a moment, Norman could see nothing but blackness beyond. They moved forward cautiously, shone their lights through the open door, saw girders, a complex of metal tubes.
Check the air, Beth.
Beth pulled the plunger on a small gas monitor in her hand. The readout screen glowed. Nitrogen, oxygen, trace CO2 and water vapor. The right proportions. It's Earth atmosphere.
Contaminants?
No.
Okay. One at a time.
Barnes removed his helmet first, breathed the air.
It seems okay. Metallic, a slight tingle, but okay.
He took a few deep breaths, then nodded. The others removed their helmets, set them on the deck.
That's better.
Shall we go?
Why not?
There was a brief hesitation, and then Beth stepped through quickly. Ladies first. The others followed her. Norman glanced back, saw all their yellow helmets lying on the floor. Edmonds, holding the video camera to her eye, said, "Go ahead, Dr. Johnson." Norman turned and stepped into the spacecraft. Interior. They stood on a catwalk 5 feet wide, suspended high in the air. Norman shone his flashlight down. The beam glowed through 40 feet of darkness before it splashed on the lower hull. Surrounding them, dimly visible in the darkness, was a dense network of struts and girders. Beth said, "It's like being in an oil refinery." She shone her light on one steel beam. Stenciled was AVR-09. All the stenciling was in English.
"Most of what you see is structural," Barnes said. "Cross-stress bracing for the outer hull gives tremendous support along all axes. The ship is very ruggedly built, as we suspected, designed to take extraordinary stresses. There's probably another hull further in."
Norman was reminded that Barnes had once been an aeronautical engineer.
Not only that, Harry said, shining his light on the outer hull. Look at this, a layer of lead.
Radiation shield?
Must be. It's 6 inches thick.
So this ship was built to handle a lot of radiation.
A hell of a lot, Harry said.
There was a haze in the ship, and a faintly